Namaste and welcome to the Bharat Varta Weekly. We have a full house here today. So we have Abhishek Paul, who's been absent for a while now. Hey, Abhishek. Hi.
Hi, Kari. Hi, everyone.
Good to have you back. We have Prasanna Vishwanathan as well. Hi, Prasanna.
Hey, happy New Year. Happy 2022.
Happy New Year to everyone. And then, of course, we have Nirav as well joining us. We have plenty to discuss on this weekly. We have, of course, the Omicron spike, the third wave. India is in the grip of that. And we'll talk about the healthcare impact and also the policy response. Then, of course, we had the unfortunate incident of a security lapse on Prime Minister Modi's visit to Punjab. You know, elections have been announced in a few key states as well. So we'll discuss that. India's GDP numbers are out, and you know, obviously Nirav will have some perspectives on that for sure. And then, yeah, something that all of us will talk about is the India-South Africa test series. India lost the second test match, right? So yeah, all right, plenty to talk about. Let's get started. But before we move on to the news, we put out an episode last week on the legend of Birsa Munda. Tuhin is a you've seen Tuhin earlier on the podcast where he was talking about his earlier book on Shenzhen, right? Mission Shenzhen, I think, if I'm not mistaken. This was a very interesting book. I hadn't known about Birsa Munda, and I wonder, you know, how many other, you know, freedom fighters or, you know, characters from contemporary history we don't really know or understand enough about, right? So it was very interesting to know more about him. It's a short 30-minute episode. Do check it out. And of course, buy the book on Amazon or Flipkart. We're seeing a huge spike in the number of cases in India. It was reported over 1.59 lakh fresh COVID cases have happened. The Omicron tally currently stands at 3,600. Delhi and Mumbai reported more than 20,000 new COVID cases in the last 24 hours. There were 48,178 active cases in Delhi currently. Exactly a month ago on December 9th, the city had 386 active cases. So that's a huge jump, right? The Prime Minister also congratulated the nation on crossing the 150 crore COVID-19 vaccination mark. So, you know, Nirav, we're seeing these spikes in all of the major cities, right? Here in Bangalore, the government has announced a curfew, right? 10 p.m. onwards. And then weekend, of course, you can't really travel out and so on. What do you see as the response, the right response to this right now? Because I think it's a reality that we'll be living with.
So I think basically this is, you're seeing the spikes everywhere, right? So you've seen U.S. had like over 10 lakh cases, so a million cases in a day. Countries like UK and France are having more than 2 lakh cases a day. So one thing is that this probably is going to reach almost everyone. And so the only way to be is like be reasonably cautious. See, without panicking. Most of the cases in Mumbai, the BMC commissioner Iqbal Chahal had mentioned that 96% of the cases requiring oxygen are the ones who did not have a single dose of vaccination. So vaccines do work for senior citizens and medical personnel. I think a booster shot will be available from Monday. So tomorrow. So without like queuing up too much or like crowding and creating more super spreader events, probably people should go and get their boosters, the ones who are eligible. As well as I think we all have to learn to live with it. I am living in Singapore and here also the cases are spiking up. But the government, what they have done is they've stopped publishing, or they used to have a daily WhatsApp update. They've stopped publishing the numbers, daily numbers. So things to monitor are probably hospital bed utilization, oxygen cylinder requirements, the number of serious cases, right? Probably, this is all anecdotal. My dad also was just tested positive, but like a lot of people have tested positive. And the recovery time is 3 to 4 days. So hopefully, maybe this is the natural vaccine. I think on Swarajya Mag, Jaggi had a very nice article about that the virus is behaving more rationally than politicians or media people, right? I think by spreading panic, we only make the situation worse. So probably, maybe this is the way the pandemic ends. I'm trying to be hopeful here. And yes, some sort of measures, people themselves are reducing. So we can track Google mobility on Google or like Apple mobility, and which tells you some sort of people have restricted their own commutes. More companies have gone from work from home. There are sort of night curfews. There's a lot of debate. Like, is it Is it a good thing, a bad thing? I think at this moment, just like let's live with it. A good sign probably is South Africa and Netherlands. So I think maybe Omicron, actually, if you look at all the cases globally, originated in Netherlands and went to South Africa. And the cases there have peaked and then again come down in about a month and a half, right? Month and a half to 2 months. So hopefully we should be done soon. So I feel this is light at the end of the tunnel. Maybe if you are vaccinated and if you still do get COVID, it's a mild one. And hopefully this provides you immunity against any further variants. So keeping fingers crossed, let's all not panic. I think be cautious and move on.
Yeah, no, the recoveries have been swift, right? And also we've seen that it's the infection is not translating to a hospitalization or like anything serious as such. Yeah, I mean, let's hope that this is the nature's vaccine and, you know, we see an end sometime soon. The assembly election dates for a few key states have been announced. The Election Commission announced dates for polls in Uttar Pradesh, Punjab, Goa, Manipur, and Uttarakhand. The officials also met last week to discuss other measures, including extending voting times by an hour and setting up extra polling booths in a few key places to ensure social distancing. Prasanna, I mean, as we talk about, you know, life continuing to move on and so on, right? Elections are a key part of the democracy, the democratic process. And what do you make of people saying that, you know, they should be postponed or, you know, that we should wait it out and stuff like that?
I think like one of the key proposals that Prime Minister Modi has made not once, he's probably been reiterating as well, is this frequency of elections, okay? Which honestly, according to me, in a hugely competitive democracy like India, you know, is a huge setback to the governance process, actually. You know, especially the staggered multi-phase elections, right? It's pretty much the entire government machinery comes to a standstill and you have like a draconian code of conduct, which doesn't really help things. Basically, bureaucratic overkill, all the power goes to them and, you know, and every, see, today, the whole world is a stage because of the social media, you know, some remote by-election, inconsequential election happening in some obscure corner of India is also amplified as a, as a quote unquote, like a mandate or a feedback to the government, you know, which has certainly a bearing. See, ultimately, politicians are always wary of verdicts, right? Like, so again, I see this election, I think, I don't know whether it's going to play out like what happened during the Delta wave. You have multiple phases of election, especially in UP. And honestly, let me tell you that like elections means the politicians and the contesting parties have every right to campaign and take their message aggressively to the audience. And if you really think that there is a public health crisis, then I think like, the party should have sit together and then, you know, delayed. I mean, there are definitely provisions in the constitution where, you know, you could delay it, like say 3 to 4 months, or, you know, you can link it to some metric around cases and all that. So this entire thing where, you know, if the ruling party takes an initiative to kind of reschedule it, then the narrative will be that they fear losing. And if the opposition does it, I'm sure the ruling party would think that they are on the back foot, you know, so it's complete deadlock. And let's see how this entire electioneering coincides with how this wave is going to ebb and flow, you know. I mean, if it kind of behaves and plays out the way it does in South Africa, then, you know, probably it won't be like as, the entire Delta, the narrative around the Delta variant of the election happened. Like basically, singular focus was only on Prime Minister's rally, while, you know, you had all other politicians in Tamil Nadu, Kerala, West Bengal, merrily carrying on with their electioneering and all that stuff, you know. So this entire public health debate, you know, gets so partisan and so politicized that, you know, we can't really have a sensible debate around it. I personally would have thought that, you know, we could have done this in April, right when we clearly know that this wave is on the upswing and, you know, probably the state capacity is limited. And moment the code of conduct comes, the entire government machinery is kind of focused on the election. Okay, so I think there is a distraction certainly, right, when this happens. And let's see how it, I mean, one good thing I've seen is some of the states have banned rallies till at least next 2-3 weeks, right? Uttarakhand, for instance.
So the election commission has said no rallies, etc., till the 15th of Jan. For all states, and then they will give new instructions that time. Right?
I really hope, you know, there's a very healthy and a very non-partisan debate where I think we should move towards at least, like, if not one nation, one election, at least one nation, two election cycles, you know, like basically you have parliamentary elections once every 5 years and then, you know, a series of state elections, at least like say twice within that 5 years. You mean you could club together and do that. And anyway, I think it's we and media are not complaining, you know, so a lot of opportunities for all the mandalized analysis and, you know, which subcaste in UP is voting for which party, and, you know, social engineering, polling and micromanagement, campaign strategy. A great time for political junkies, media, and of course the politicians and all. But I really, I don't know, I mean, from a larger perspective of the nation, how useful this is doing it at this time of time. We could have certainly delayed this. That's my sense.
No, it's a very difficult decision, right? But because it's a, from an opposition perspective, it's a heads I win, tails you lose kind of a thing, right? Because what do you do? I mean, especially after the second wave was squarely blamed on election rallies, when the data indicates that nothing of that sort, right? I mean, you know, where it originated, whether it's TN or Kerala or Maharashtra, right? So yeah, I mean, it's an interesting situation. I think all of us can agree that, you know, there are just way too many elections.
Just to give you one simple example, okay, like right now as we are speaking, I mean, I'm very happy about it because I am one of the guys who've been upfront saying that, you know, ultimately people have to make choices here. Like when first wave happened, lockdown was understandable because we didn't understand the nature of the beast. But all the celebration, revelry, people should be allowed to participate fully knowing that there are health hazards or issues like that. Right now, as we speak, there is a huge congregation happening in West Bengal of the Sagar Island, a religious congregation, which has been permitted by the state government, the same set of politicians from the party who kind of, you know, held Kumbh responsible for the spread of virus. So no, there is no first principles here, actually. It's all, you know, it's completely degenerated to such partisanship that, you know, we can't really have a useful debate on this.
Yeah. Himang Palan has an interesting comment. He says, digital rallies and outreach is a welcome step and they should be continued even after the COVID era, saving us from roadblocks and...
Abhishek or Nirav can say, I think it was proposed during the Bihar election, but obviously, you know, there is always this acquisition that BJP is like all powerful digital machinery that will overpower, and, you know, and this is like a digital divide in the country. So poor will not participate. All these kind of, some of it may be valid concern. All this comes. So I think, like, I mean, I don't know, like, see, that's why my point is that if elections have to be held and there is a level playing field, parties should be allowed to mobilize, campaign, take the message. So if the health situation is not permitting, you know, electioneering the way it should be, I think we can wait for the situation to improve, right? So, I mean, there's nothing.
Yeah. All right, moving on. Prime Minister Modi's visit to Punjab was marred by a security incident as his car unexpectedly stopped for over an hour. The 110-kilometer stretch between Bathinda and Ferozpur was sealed for normal traffic. However, the security plan went for a toss when a farmer's jatta led by Bharatiya Kisan Union, Krantikari, blocked the main Moga-Ferozpur highway. Even as the Punjab government maintains that the alleged security lapse occurred due to a last-minute change in travel plans, a 32-page report has surfaced which shows that the administration had already prepared alternate security cover and also route plans. Nirav, this was an interesting situation, right?
So I think a couple of things. One is, regardless of your political affiliation, regardless of who's in power in the state or the center, I think any sort of breach for security for our elected leaders is a very serious threat. It could be domestic, it could be foreign, you don't know who's behind it. So I think that has to be taken very seriously. People need to be seeing that who was responsible. There's some sort of an audit that needs to come out of this, right? It is very unfortunate. We've had two prime ministers assassinated, Srimati Indira Gandhi and her son Rajiv Gandhi. And such things should not repeat, irrespective of whichever things. Second thing is that I think this farmers' protest has gone on for a bit too long, and they've caused more disruption than actual giving any sensible suggestions, etc. And after the farmers' demands were met, I think they said next thing was talking about, like, say, things like Article 370, etc., which are completely not related. So I think it is like people are adhering to a tribe or their political affiliation, and this opposing for the sake of opposing. I think this has gone a bit too far. The country seems to be like very polarized. And on social media, you've seen some people actually cheering this fact. So I think that has to go. We need to agree that whoever our elected representative is, whether we agree with their politics or no, whether we voted for them or no, they need to be safe. And second thing is that there was a sensible action taken by withdrawing. So at times, either when you play like chess or any sport, sometimes you need to take a step back so as to be able to win ahead, right? So I think that has been taken. You've seen the PM kind of take a step back, not go through with the rally, not go through with his address there. So probably it's a safe thing, and safety comes first. I'm quite disheartened by this thing. There's always been a talk of like about a 2.5 front war, which half a front is within. And we need a bit of introspection that we have a democracy. We've had peaceful change in power in states and center, etc. I don't think these are the ways to conduct your voice your opposition. I think there is a election process. There are other forums. I think they need to be kept. I think it's a very sad day. Thankfully, there was no harm done, but we need to learn something out of this.
Do you think that, you know, this was a genuine mishandling, or there was some kind of a grand descent to it? I mean, this is a question to all of you.
So, see, it's very tough to say. And that's why we need some sort of like an audit done. They always say that don't attribute to malice, which could be attributed to incompetence. So maybe you can give some benefit of doubt. But that doesn't mean, like, let there be some sort of investigation and the real truth come up, and some sort of action should be taken that this is avoided. I don't know, like, maybe Prasanna and Abhishek can add to this.
Yeah, no, I mean, Twitter is full of, you know, various theories, you know, ranging from a possible assassination attempt to, you know, forces beyond the border being involved in it, right?
Interestingly, Roshan, I think, you know, I don't know whether it's an eerie coincidence or maybe, you know, people just got to that video right now. 1 year back, Khalistani propaganda video exactly played out this scenario, actually. You know, like there is a convoclade of Prime Minister going exactly on a flyover where he gets blocked by a set of protesting farmers. And then there is a sudden and a rapid attack, and Prime Minister is kind of, you know, physically harmed. You know, this is like a kind of a gamified song, of course, with this, you know, noisy Punjabi music to go with that, to add an element of drama. And so, you know, like, see, of course, I think when we are talking about a possible assassination attempt, I think the bar for evidence should be certainly higher, and only a enquiry can establish it. But I don't think so. This suggestions that, you know, the security breach could have possibly led to the physical harm of the prime minister. I think those are as credible. I mean, they're not just like passionate supporters, you know, coming up with some theories. And I don't know what is the end game for the protesters in Punjab. Certainly, I think there is an element of what I call an emotional supremacism at play. You know, see, basically, as Nirav said, the basic demand has been conceded, you know, though it was a huge climb down for the prime minister from a political perspective. I think like they are just emboldened by the fact that BJP prime minister and, you know, the larger Hindu movement in the country is kind of decided to take a very reconciliatory approach to this entire issue, you know. And I think like if you really look at dealing with groups which are very you know, I mean, I want to be very careful with the words that I choose here, you know, which kind of are prone to this kind of mobilization and violence. I think sometimes, you know, even Indira Gandhi made this blunder, is that like any climb down, of course, as Nirav said, so, I mean, you can't be, you need to nuance your strategy, and sometimes, you know, you need to compromise and generally de-escalate the vitiated political environment. All that is fine, but sometimes conceding to these forces also, you know, empowers them actually, you know. I mean, for instance, I would say the only societies currently, authoritarian society, I mean, countries or states, they have the only ones been able to consistently clamp down these type of movements because, you know, they kind of can operate without a principle that they will never compromise, actually. There's no room for dissent. So while you know, I kind of understand from where Prime Minister withdrew this farm law legislation, you know, even to the extent that he did it on a day which was religiously significant to the community, you know, there is something else. I think, like, you know, this kind of structural issues, I think Modi might have one more term, whatever time, but I think the state, the issue in the state is far a structural, lot of sinister forces are at play, and I think this is going to thing. And tragically, the last point that I'd want to make is that the current Congress party itself faced a huge blowback based on what it did in Punjab, you know, and to see them celebrating in a very triumphalist way, I think, you know, it's pretty much shows how much they kind of disconnected, you know. And I would assume that Congress is has still some pretensions to being a national force. I mean, of course, it is true, actually. So, you know, this election verdicts are cyclical, you know, in Indian democracy. You know, even people more popular than Modi have lost power. So, you know, power is not permanent, but certain institutions, like institutions of prime minister and all that, those are very critical, you know. So it's quite tragic the way Congress, you know, just... And it would be funny if they lose Punjab after doing all this. You know, you never know. And AAP might still, quote unquote, you know, pull in a bit of it. I mean, pull a surprise or two, you know, like it essentially comes down to how the Hindus of the state are going to, you know, look at who's going to eventually win, and they might jump onto that bandwagon. So this should be interesting. After doing all this, you not only lose credibility as a national party, you know, it would be very silly if you lose a state. I mean, and this is a state where BJP virtually has no political stakes, you know, and even from a larger electoral landscape, you know, what it, I mean, I don't think so. It hardly accounts for anything, you know. So let's see how the Punjab verdict finally comes.
Yeah. No, interesting times for sure. Also, do check out the episode on Punjab politics that we did with Rohit Jayaraman, you know, some time ago. It was fairly comprehensive, covered a various facets about the state itself. Moving on. Well, the Indian team lost the second test match against South Africa, setting the third matchup as the decider for the series. India won the first test of the series, beating the Proteas quite comfortably with a margin of 113 runs. But the hosts bounced back in the second game of the series and won the second test by seven wickets. The third test is perfectly poised as a decider, and it will take place in Cape Town from January 11th. Abhishek, what are your thoughts about the second test?
Yeah, I think India had a really good chance to clinch the series here. And while they still have a chance to do it in the third test, but it is possible that they'll really regret not finishing the job here, because basically, as the match panned out, India had to defend about 240 odd runs in the fourth innings, which is typically quite a decent score to defend, right? Not many teams chase that kind of a score, and that too, the South Africans did it pretty comfortably with seven wickets, so it should kind of worry the Indian team. I think overall it was a pretty good match. Kohli missed out due to an injury, so KL Rahul was the skipper for the first time. I think India sort of should have scored a bit more in the first innings. But from that point on, they put up a good fight, managed to contain South Africa to within a 20-30 run kind of a lead. Batting quite well in the second innings, where Pujara and Rahane, as people kept on saying, were playing the last match and all that. But they both managed to put up 50s and still remain in contention for the next match. But then the later order collapsed. I think a lot of chatter around how Rishabh Pant is playing or not playing these days and all that. But yeah, I think defending 240 was a very good, like, it's at least a 50-50 chance, right? Going into the fourth innings. But South Africa really played well. So yeah, let's see how the third match in the series goes now.
I didn't watch much of the proceedings. Abhishek, did the pitch ease out in third and fourth day? Because I saw a bit of action on the second day and seemed to be helping the bowlers a bit. So
I think the pitch had a peculiar characteristic of where immediately after an innings change with the rollers and all, it seemed to get flat. And then maybe after 25-30 overs, it would again sort of start helping the bowlers.
Okay.
But I think what happened is Mohammad Siraj got a little injured. So he could not really bowl with his usual
energy.
And then, so Shardul Thakur really had a very good first innings, took seven.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't expect him to do that every time. Maybe Bumrah and Shami were not at their best,
yeah,
possibly.
Yeah, I think like one of the things was our first innings runs, obviously below par. And as like Prasanna pointed out, every innings, actually the score got better, right? So like what happened is that progressively, possibly either the batsmen got to terms with the pitch or the bowlers were getting too tired or the pitch was getting better. So like, but that's whichever way it is, but that's what it is. Hopefully we see, I think like looking ahead at the next test, we see Kohli coming back, strengthening the middle order. Maybe if Siraj is still injured, possibly either Ishant Sharma or Umesh Yadav comes in. And with this kind of like a bit of rest, hopefully like Bumrah, Shami are recharged and firing on all cylinders. So fingers crossed to win this. It's been a very interesting week for cricket. So you had like Bangladesh upset New Zealand in a test. It really hurts as an India supporter because India has not won in New Zealand recently and Bangladesh did. So that was one big surprise. You have the ongoing Ashes where right now probably England might actually escape with a draw, which they might actually think of it as a win, given that they are 3-0 down. So it's been, the new year has brought in like a series of upsets, right? Like all the previous results are kind of being flipped. Let's see if this continues. Like, I'm excited for this Cape Town test. This is, as we've said before, like, this is India's best chance to win in South Africa. That's one country where India has never won a test series. We are 1-1 in. I think India is the better team on paper. It's all about executing and all the blocks falling in place on those 5 days. So fingers crossed we win the series.
This week, I think there's been some top class tweets and memes on, England losing and Kohli's form, etc. Right? Someone said that Kohli and Mitchell Starc have the same batting average.
Yes.
In tests over the last year, apparently.
Oh,
so,
is it? Oh, okay.
Yeah, Mitchell Starc comes in at the end, scores like a quick 20, and like Kohli comes in between and still scores a 20. So, yeah, both average about 26, 27.
Actually, Australian lower order is quite a handful, right? Like, even humans can kind of wield the stick.
They've always been that way, right? I mean, I remember Jason Gillespie scoring 201.
Right? No, so also, what has happened is, in this series, that the way they've dominated England, so when these batsmen at number 8 or 9 are coming in, already the team is tired after bowling 120 overs and they're down on the mat, like, mentally. That time it's easier to score about 20 odd runs. So it's not as if Mitchell Starc would do the same adding input at Kohli's position. But yes, it's a statistical quirk and it's true. So
moving on. India's GDP seems poised to break out of the COVID slump as government data predicts that it will rise to 9.2% in FY22. The numbers are set to surpass pre-COVID levels at ₹145.69 lakh crore, mainly on account of improved performance, especially in farm, mining and manufacturing sectors. The improvement in the economy comes after a GDP contraction of 7.3% during 2021 due to the pandemic and the resultant lockdowns imposed to curb the spread of the deadly coronavirus. The NSO estimates are a tad lower than the 9.5% GDP growth projection of the Reserve Bank of India. Nirav, promising numbers?
Yeah. So, see, like, you know what? If you look hard enough at like a lot of data, you can choose whatever you want to choose to look at, right? You're having Kaushik Basu saying that, oh my God, in 2 years, you're only grown at like 0.6%. So you have to look at the context, you have to look at the circumstances, you have to look at how well India was equipped. So basically, I'm looking at glasses like 3/4 or 80% full. What has happened is GDP is a flow number. It is the output per year. So it's not as if people have not made any money in the last 2 years. It is that the amount of output, it fell about 9% in real terms, and it has risen again 9%. So basically, we are roughly where we ended up, right? I think it fell down 8, and then because of mathematics, like 1.09 into 0.92, we cross. So we are a 3 trillion economy still. Few things, this is the real economy, so net of inflation, nominally we've increased. You look at another high frequency data point, which is monthly GST collection. Pre-COVID, we were at a run rate of 1 lakh crores a month. And now the average run rate is 1.3 lakh crores a month. So we've grown about 30% in the goods and services which are being taxed under GST. So it's not everything, it's a percentage of it. You look at exports have risen to quite a bit. They are averaging about $37-38 billion a month, right? Imports have risen a lot. But if you really go drill down, so our trade deficit on goods is minus $22 billion a month. So we are importing $60 billion. But in terms of volumes, the imports are flat. What has happened is the price of our imports has gone up. So price of oil, price of machinery, you're seeing a lot of inflation in the developed world. So whatever we are importing has gotten more expensive. Hopefully that leads to like a positive swing on our exports as well. What Indian government has done here is a few things. One is, during the pandemic, when our imports and demand collapsed, we did not let the rupee strengthen a lot. In fact, by maintaining rupee stable, we've increased our foreign currency reserves over 2 years to over $645 billion. This leaves us with enough defense in case in the Western world, the Fed starts raising rates and money starts being pulled out, right? So that's a very good positive. Two is when the oil prices collapsed, the government, so that was done by the RBI. The government did not pass through all the benefit to the consumers, despite like a lot of people being against it. What they did was they increased the excise duties and raised tax collection from fuel when GST and income tax collection was lower, right? So kind of they offset it. And now when prices are rising again, they're cutting back the taxes. So I think they did a counter-cyclical measure. Again, all of these are prudent steps, saving for a rainy day. So I'm saying you need to look at what all the things have been done right. And instead of what, you know, oh, we've only kind of reached back what we were 2 years ago. A lot of people have lost 2 years to the pandemic. Sadly, a lot of lives have been lost. But what all this shows is the momentum is in the right place. So we've gotten through. India famously, right? What we've done is we've done the other way around. We've liberalized our IT services and financial sector the first, which is the tertiary sector. We did some good reforms on the manufacturing sector. So labor laws have been simplified. We've got PLI schemes. Biggest one is semiconductors, but also auto parts and pharma. A lot of incentives to electric vehicles. So what we've done is in these 2 years during the pandemic, because we had a nice window where everyone came together to fight the pandemic, we passed through a lot of reforms on the manufacturing side. I am very upset personally that we could not pass through the reforms on the agri side. Hopefully, maybe the window turns and it's done sometime later. Again, you look at glass half full or glass half empty. We managed to privatize Air India, but BPCL or LIC IPO have been delayed. So I think there are a lot of good things happened. Obviously, it's not perfect. But if you look at the momentum, it's in the right direction. I believe Omicron will be done and gone before these whole elections start, election rallies start, hopefully. And so what we see is after April onwards in the next fiscal year, we carry this momentum forward and we have another strong year of 8% plus GDP growth and stable inflation about 4 to 5%. So I think if that carries forward, that, you know, it reignites animal spirits. Nilkant Mishra, who works at Credit Suisse, is also part of PM's advisory council. He's a very nice article. He talks about animal spirits and he says that, you know, what are animal spirits? It is like doing something, either investing or buying some goods or consuming, where you lose money immediately. When you buy a stock, you lose money of your brokerage immediately, right? But in anticipation of greater profits elsewhere. You are investing to put up a factory, you are expanding a shop, you're buying more goods. I think that has to be seen as a big win. Another one I wanted to highlight, it was started in 2020 with all the inflows into Jio, where a lot of global companies were investing into Jio. And in 2021 was the year of the unicorns. And with the UPI interface, multiple payment apps, a lot of payment apps being unicorns, you are seeing this go down to the roadside Nariyal Paniwala or the idli seller on the road also accepting payments via digital payments, right? UPI. I think all of this, which has happened due to the pandemic where people wanted to minimize contact and like more online deliveries, is like a huge positive which will carry forward later even as we move to normal, right? So I think it's a lot of these are good things. If you want to focus on the few sad things, see, India is a poor country. Our GDP, while an aggregate 3 trillion, I think you're the fifth or sixth biggest country, the way you look at all the exchange rates. But per capita, we are still about a little over $2,000, right? So we are still a poor country. We've had 2 years. One was a very bad, sharp slowdown. Now we've recovered. And now hopefully we carry forward this momentum into the next decade. The whole decade, if we see this momentum, it should be fantastic. So we go from like poor country or to lower middle income country to a middle income country. And I think it's possible. So absolutely.
I think just to add on to what Neeraj said, like say in terms of the government revenues, I think this is going to be a windfall year for tax collections, you know, yes. Like GST, direct tax, both, you know, also the corporate tax, you know, I think this, to what extent, you know, the government should use this money to maybe further impart some fiscal momentum to the economy is something that can be debated. But from purely from a revenue inflow perspective to the government, this is going to be fabulous. And I think like BPCL, I would be a little charitable to the government. You know, I think it's not about the intent in this case or execution in this case. Globally, if you really look at, I think all the big funds, the big investors, everyone is very wary of putting any money in oil and gas and, you know, any sector that is seen as being the conventional energy, right? So I think BPCL is kind of, you know, inability to, despite having 23% market share in the oil retail, I think it's not the, it's just the cyclical, it's caught in this kind of, you know, investment philosophy, which is completely, you know, quote unquote, blacklisting energy related investments in conventional sector. Hopefully, you know, somebody should see the merit that, especially in a country like India, oil will be a huge, you know, player in the energy mix, at least for the next 2-3 decades. So hopefully they do find a buyer. And I think LIC IPO to some extent will help government reach its disinvestment target. But yeah, you could, again, BPCL, again, I don't know whether, I mean, it's like, I would personally not be inclined to blame it as a government failure, actually.
Absolutely. One more thing I just wanted to add on the economy. I think a lot of the Western countries, they did a massive fiscal stimulus, right? To the account of about like 20% of GDP, which has led to the government debt rising a lot and inflation being very high. So fun fact, like India last inflation number was about 4.9%. And in the US it is 6.8%, right? Where like US interest rates are still at zero. So I think what has happened is India knows that when the whole economy is shut, doing a lot of fiscal spending is not going to lead to much. It'll actually lead to overheating and inflation. We've made this mistake in 2008 and 2009. I think Dr. Subbarao, was the RBI governor then, also like reluctantly agrees that what had happened then was a policy error, being like a little too cautious. And so this time, what has happened is we've learned from those mistakes. So we've not done that. I think as the economy opens up and this like higher tax collection that we are seeing, it's a K-shaped recovery, sadly. But what has happened is the top 1%, which are all involved in all these tech IPOs, etc., and the top 10% have done well. And they are the ones who pay taxes. So top 1% pays predominantly bigger amount of taxes. So that is the tax collections are actually better. The unfortunate part is the very poor people, anyways, they don't contribute to taxes and they've done a little bit worse. But this, hopefully, fiscal spending will benefit them later, right? So that is why I feel that, yes, 9.2%, not just like for this year, but going in, if we, this Omicron variant is probably the last one variant of concern, and this becomes endemic and we move on, I think we could see like a bumper fiscal year 23 as well. So hopefully the momentum gets carried forward.
And that's critical from a political perspective as well for the government, right? To have 1 or 2 years of good economic growth. Yeah. So I think, I mean, you can expect that they will do everything possible for to enable that for sure, right? Before 2024. All right. So that's a wrap from us today. Upcoming, we have an interesting conversation lined up with Professor Shamika Ravi. She is, of course, the expert on COVID. I mean, she's been absolutely amazing in terms of, you know, lending data and perspectives. So one thing that everyone is, and we discussed it briefly on this podcast as well, that, you know, what should the ideal healthcare or policy response be to COVID, right? And that is something that we will be talking to her about. So do check it out. All right. Thank you so much for joining us from Abhishek, Prasanna and myself. Stay safe, take care, and see you soon.
Bye.